and page 11 in your notebooks. The divorce lesson, the divorce part of this class, it's broken down into two sections, two subsections. Look at some Old Testament passages, which we're currently in right now, and then when we get through with them, we just pick three. And then we'll look at some New Testament passages that, given where we live, as they say sometimes, this side of the cross, that's more germane to our situations than what we find in the Old Testament, those passages. Not that they're not important, we can't learn from them, but the New Testament text will be more relevant to us. And we're going to finish up the Deuteronomy 24 section this morning and then look at the passage there in Ezra and then on to Malachi, and then we'll get to the New Testament. We were talking about this Wednesday night, the reason for the passage there in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, is the Israelites were already, apparently, already divorcing and remarrying. And that section of the law was given to kind of regulate that. It should not be seen as an approval from God that these Hebrew men were doing this to their wives. This section was to regulate an undesirable situation. What was expressly forbidden, as you see there in the text, was the return of the wife to her first husband after he had divorced her and after her subsequent remarriage to another man. And then if he put her away or he died, as you see, then she was forbidden by the law to return to her first husband. So that's what was expressly forbidden. What was not expressly forbidden in the text was her remarrying someone else. And there are some who take that to be that, well, that was okay with God. No, that's an implication that is not supported by a correct view of the text. Just because it wasn't expressly forbidden doesn't mean that God approved of it or He liked it. He just tolerated it, I think we can see. And we know that from Matthew 19 and Mark 10, as we'll see just in a moment with the words of Jesus. Hard hearts, Matthew 19, Mark 10. That's why Jesus said this was given, as you remember. The Jews said, then why did Moses command this? And Jesus said, well, Moses allowed this. Moses permitted this. Some versions say Moses suffered this because of the hardness of your hearts. And then he finished that answer by saying, but from the beginning, what? That's not the way God intended it from the beginning. And when he says beginning, what's he referring to? That's right, Genesis 2, the passage we spent some time on in the marriage section of this class, the model for marriage and the plan, the divine plan for marriage. So we got through all this Wednesday night. The woman's defilement was not her second divorce. That's not what defiled her. Because whether she was divorced or what else would happen with respect to the second husband, if he died, see, she's in the same position. She's in the same boat. She could not go back whether he divorced or whether he died. So it wasn't the divorce that defiled her. It was her second or her subsequent marriage. That's what God was trying to regulate. Okay. Now, this is question four, and this has got a lot of discussion with respect to this text. Again, Deuteronomy chapter 24. And verse 1, the New American Standard reads, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. Now, the New King James has, I believe, the word uncleanness. Is that correct? All right. Is there any other translations that anybody's here using that has different words other than indecency or uncleanness? Anybody else? Okay, so it's an indecency or some uncleanness. And the man sees this in her, he finds this in her, and that is the reason for him then putting her away, sending her away, giving her that bill of divorcement that the law required, and then out she goes. Now, what I'm asking is, what do you think this indecency was or this uncleanness was? Well, some say some sort of sin. I guess that's possible. Before we sometimes can decide what something is, we first must know what it's not. That kind of removes things from the discussion so that we don't have to spend our time on incorrect answers. Do we know what this would not be that we could rule out, safely rule out?
All right.
We know it's not some sexual sin, don't we? We have to know that. Because what did the law say about things like that, Rick?
She was to be stoned.
She was to be stoned. So there'd be no putting her away. She's dead. So if she was an adulteress, if she went out and committed fornication, lay with another man, if she lay with another woman, those kinds of evils, those kinds of sexual deviancies, the law said, well, not just her. What if she's guilty of adultery? Her and the man were to be stoned. So the law took care of that. So we know that it was not a sexual sin, and we're citing Leviticus 20, and then the larger text there in Deuteronomy 22, 13 to 27, just a couple of chapters before this, you can read all those situations that the law categorizes. There are catalogs there, what was to be done if someone was guilty of that kind of behavior. So we know it was not anything sexual. We can safely say that. So someone says, well, I believe this indecency was if she was unfaithful to him. No, that's not correct. Can't be that. Because as Rick points out, the law deals with that elsewhere. Okay, so we can rule that out. Then what do you think it is? Well, okay, some say just for whatever he chose. I read some writers that I don't know how they got this information and how reliable it is, but some said, well, the Jews even practiced if the wife overcooked the food. She was a bad cook. To him, that's an indecent thing. Well, that's kind of nilly-willy, isn't it? That's kind of... Well, okay, but the law did address that too, did it not? If a Hebrew came in contact with a dead carcass of an animal or of a dead human, did the law address that? It did. Now, maybe that's would fit in here. I don't know. I'm having a lot of I don't knows. We can't say for certain what it is. There's one thing that I do want to point your attention to. And I've got it listed there in the question. Deuteronomy 23 and verse 14. If you turn back to the previous chapter, and I am by no means a Hebrew expert. He's down the hallway. So drop my clicker. But I did talk to Bob about this, and he looked at me in the Hebrew text, and he reassured me, that it is exactly the same wording, syntax, and everything in the Hebrew text at Deuteronomy 23:14 as it is here in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1. If you look in Deuteronomy 23 and verse 14, the context begins in verse 9 and is talking about the camp. And God had a concern about something. Verse 11, speaking of just a Hebrew man, it shall be when evening approaches, he shall bathe himself with water, and at sundown he may re-enter the camp. You shall also have a place outside the camp to go out there. Talking about sanitary concerns here. You shall have a spade among your tools, and it shall be when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn to cover up your excrement. The New American Standard reads. Now verse 14. Since the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to defeat your enemies before you, therefore your camp must be holy, and he must not see, mine says, anything indecent. King James says what? Anything unclean among you, lest he turn away from you. The concern was God dwelt among the people. These are my people. This is their camp. This is my camp. If there's anything indecent or unclean or defiling in the camp, what couldn't God do? God couldn't interact with them. So he said, and this is just it's a normal bodily function. Everybody is subject to that. But God says, here's what the law stipulates. Now you go outside the camp and you do that. Don't do it in the camp because that's going to defile the camp. So here's an example of just something that was unclean, something indecent. Okay? Sanitary wise is the principle. Some may say, well, maybe it was some kind of a moral or some kind of a ceremonial indecency. Whatever it was, the law did not specify, but it was something that the man saw in his wife. And he decided, I don't want the marriage to continue. So here's the bill of divorcement, and puts it in her hand, and he sends her away. All right. How does that appear? Just on the surface, with respect to the marriage. You think that's something that God was proud of? Obviously not. Obviously. We've already spent too much time in the marriage section of this class on all those other Old Testament passages, especially Genesis 2, that tell us what God thought about marriage. It was a covenant. It was a lifelong covenant. And now you have situations where the man was just at his own will, on a whim. This in you, this trait, this character, this whatever it was, this behavior, to me that is indecent. And so I'm going to put you away. And he did. Well, the question is, could the woman do the same thing to her husband? What did the law give women as far as rights? It didn't have any. I don't know if the reverse could be argued with irrespective of gender, Brother Miller, I don't know. But typically speaking, we look back through the law, and women didn't have any. Didn't have any rights. So this pretty much, I would guess, would be a one-way street. How men were dealing with their wives. Okay. So again, we're just emphasizing this passage, the presence of it in the law. It is, of course, we cannot with a straight face say that this was something that God was that God approved of and that God was proud of. It was tolerance. This provision of the law was given to regulate behavior that was already existing, that he was trying to keep from getting into chaos, keep it somewhat under control. It has his approval in the sense that they could do it because the law addressed it, but it does not have his approval in the sense that God was pleased with it, obviously. I'm not trying to split words here, but I think you see the difference we're trying to make. Okay. Now we'll look at Matthew 19, and this, of course, is question 5. The thought question there: if God didn't like that, then why would He tell Moses to put that part in the law? Well, if all we had was the law, we didn't have these passages that Jesus spoke, we would be bereft of some very important information. But thankfully, the Son of God commented on this and gave us the reason why it was put in the law. Matthew 19, Mark 10, parallel passages. They had this discussion. Jesus and the Pharisees had this discussion. As Matthew 19 records it, what was their question? Pharisees to Jesus. Is it lawful for what to happen? Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? Here you have a first century reference to no-fault divorce. That's so prevalent in our culture. No-fault divorce. Well, apparently in the first century, men were putting away their wives no-fault, just for any cause whatsoever. Now, already, we've not gotten to that juncture of the text of Matthew 19, but already we know what passage do these Pharisees have in mind. It's Deuteronomy 24. It has to be. Jesus will... Well, in fact, they reference it in a minute. But even before they do that, we know that's what they're thinking about. Okay, that was their question. How did Jesus answer it initially? He went back further than the law. All right. What did he say, basically? We don't have to read it word for word, but just basically what did Jesus say at the asking of that first question? All right. In fact, what does Jesus quote first? What? Which was what? Does he go right to Deuteronomy 24? He doesn't, does he? He goes to Genesis 1 and 2. Back to creation. He who made them male and female at the beginning. He talks about that. And then you see He quotes Moses in Genesis 2, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife. Consequently, therefore, they're no longer two, but they're one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." Is Jesus answering their question? They said, "Can a man divorce his wife for any reason he wants to?" Did Jesus answer the question? Yes, He did. He said, God joined them together. And we covered this in Genesis. How much authority has God given man to set aside or to put asunder that relationship? Man doesn't have that authority. So their question is answered with what? No. No, that's not so. Okay. Then what do they say? Well, then why did Moses write that? And now they cite Deuteronomy 24. What are they trying to do? That's right. And with respect to Jesus, what are they trying to do? That's right. In fact, doesn't Matthew record that? And Mark also. At the start of the context, what's it say? They come to Jesus testing Him. They were not sincere searchers of truth. They were not in this to learn anything. They're wanting to put Jesus on the horns of a dilemma here. What if He says this? We've got Him. Saying what He did say, then they say, well, Moses said this. Now, you're saying this. You're going to have a problem, Jesus. Because we have what Moses said. And as Matthew records it, their question is, why then did Moses command that a writing of divorcement be given? Well, before He says the hardness of your hearts, Jesus corrected them, did He not? What did He say? Jesus is getting a little semantic here. No, He permitted it. It was not a command. It's a command in the law in that if that behavior took place, that part of the law had to be obeyed. But it wasn't a command in that that's what God says, this is what I want you to do. This is behavior that I want to see in the Hebrews. No, it wasn't a command. Moses permitted it. Why, Brother Miller? Because of the hardness of your hearts. But then he goes back again to that phrase, but from the beginning, that's not the way that it was. We heard a lot of talk in the past years that this has been debated about whether or not people outside of Christ, they usually we call them alien sinners, are subject to the Lord's teaching on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. This passage has been discussed a lot in that context. Jesus does not necessarily refer to the law of the kingdom of the New Testament church, does He? He doesn't even refer to as His basis the Old Covenant law, does He? Where does He go again, Buford? He goes back to the beginning. Before there was a law, before there was the New Testament, He went back to when marriage was founded and started, and that's His basis. So are alien sinners subject to the teachings of marriage? Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
What would be the difference in that from the first principles? If they wouldn't say this part of it, they wouldn't be subject
to any of it. That's right. What could you, if you can't preach marriage, divorce, and remarriage to those outside of Christ today, then what could you preach them from the New Covenant? You didn't preach anything to them. So that was a weak argument that got a lot of attention in the last 15, 20 years or so with all those debates that brethren had about the topic. So Jesus' words to His questioners also showed the passage did not reflect God's original intentions. And His words in Matthew 19 and Mark 10 tell us that. He references Genesis chapter 2. As we said Wednesday night, one of the purposes, it seems to us, of this passage, that is Deuteronomy 24, was to provide some sort of protection for the woman who was just at the mercy of her husband to put her away for whatever reason he wanted to. And she was not to be some sort of a yo-yo, send her off and bring her back, and send her off and bring her back. This gave her some sort of recourse, if you will. But it was never meant to be seen as God's original intentions. That wasn't the case at all. And for New Testament days practice, as we see here, Jesus addresses, and the fact that they ask the question, can divorce happen just for any cause that comes down the road? Jesus answers it with a resounding no, it's not the case. Okay. Anything else on Deuteronomy 24 before we go to the next passage there? Any other options? Yes, Charles.
Well,
Yes. Yes. God had a concern about the land in Deuteronomy 24, that we not bring this pollution, this defilement upon the land. There was a national interest as well to the nation. Now, and that was redundant, wasn't it? A national interest to the people, that they be protected in terms of their identity and their distinctiveness as God's people. That's a good point to bring out. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, now turn to Ezra chapter 9. Ezra chapter 9. I know we're skipping around somewhat in terms of the chronology of the Old Testament, but I think we have enough of a compass in our heads that we can jump around the timeline there and know where we land and not get out of sorts. Contextually wise, where does Ezra fit in the Old Testament story? All right, he is one of the leaders of the three returns back from captivity. He led the, which one? One, two, or three? He led two, number two. About 458 or so B.C., we don't have to get too definite. That's not our purpose in this class. But he, in fact, there's a wonderful statement about him. It's in chapter 7 and verse 10. Ezra was a priest. Here's a good outline. Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to practice it and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel. So he studied it, he practiced it, and he taught it. So his job was to, if you think of the three returns as building projects, that's, at least that helps me in my mind keep them all together. First return led by Zerubbabel was to build what? The temple. Second return led by Ezra was to build something. But it wasn't anything physical. It was the spiritual infrastructure of the people. Temple's up, now we can worship again. And so the law had to be taught. So that was Ezra's building project, to rebuild that spiritual knowledge or spiritual infrastructure. Third return led by Nehemiah was to build the walls. So now here's Ezra. And now we jump in the middle of his story. After spending 70 years in captivity, which is what the Jews did, of course, the exilic Jews, again, took up some old sins. What about the person who does something wrong, something stupid, something dumb, and he goes back and does the same thing over again? What do you think of a fellow like that? Dumb. He's not learning from his mistakes. What was it that got the Jews in the trouble they was in the first place? Why did they go to captivity? Idolatry. Well, did the law talk about one of the more prevalent ways that would take place? How did they get in that situation? They intermarried. Because God knows, and we know too, those of us who are married, how intimate is marriage? And I don't mean just sexually, but how intimate is that relationship? I mean, you are one, as Jesus said. You talk about things and you share things. You have the same ideas and goals. You want to please one another. You share in everything. And so God's concern was, now don't go around and intermarry these pagan women, because what are they going to do? They're going to lead your heart away. What was the statement about Solomon when he married all those foreign women in his later years? The Bible says they led his heart away. And that's why he built all those houses of idol worship to his wives' gods. So 70 years in captivity, they once again pick up some old sins. And Ezra was forced to deal with some unpleasant marital situations. And we see that. And this text, if when we get through looking at it, what we're going to emphasize is, one of the things that we need to emphasize about it is that the covenant that one has with God, that relationship, must take precedence over all other relationships, even the relationship of marriage. I can't think of anything in terms of a relationship that is more important than the marriage relationship other than what one has with God. Saving our souls before God is most important. Now, you take that out of the way, is there anything more close than marriage? I can't think of not friendship, not neighbors, not co-workers, not even children, but what one has with his or her spouse. And so this passage will show us just how important being right with God is, because some things happen, as you know the story rather well, that really makes that impression upon us. So they come home from Babylonian captivity. Look at verse 1 of chapter 9. Ezra chapter 9, verse 1. Somebody approached Ezra. Who was it? The princes of the people approached me. This, of course, Ezra writing it in first person. And basically the charge in verse 1 was what? That's right. They've not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands, and you see them listed there, all those ites, Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and so forth. Verse 2, the first part of verse 2, gives us specific details. Well, in what way? I mean, are they talking across the backyard fence? Are they playing ball together? No, we're talking about marriage. They have married the daughters as wives for themselves and for our sons, so that the holy race has intermingled with the peoples of the land. And now another telling information is listed in the last half of verse 2. What made this even worse than it was on the surface? You expect more of your leaders. And the text says that the hands of the princes and the rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness. Okay, what if they're doing it? You're the average Jew out here. What are you going to think? They're doing it. I might as well do it. No problem. So that was the concern that was shown to Ezra. Intermarriage again. So this is what Ezra must deal with. Okay. How do we know this to be? Let me see what question I'm asking here. This is thanks for stealing question 7. Where was this originally addressed in the law? When they say that they've been unfaithful, that okay, unfaithful to God, now how are we going to be able to prove that? Where did the law talk about this? Exodus 34 and 16 is the first place we read it, but I think Ezra has something else in mind. Did you read his prayer? His prayer is beautiful. Ezra chapter 9. And you start in verse 6. And you read down through the end of the chapter, verse 15. That's Ezra's prayer of confession. But I want to draw your attention to start in verse 10. And now, O God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken Thy commandments, which Thou hast commanded by Thy servants the prophets, saying, the land which you are entering to possess is an unclean land, with the uncleanness of the peoples of the lands and their abominations which have filled it from end to end, and with their impurity. So now do not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters to your sons, and never seek their peace or their prosperity, that you be strong and eat the good things of the land and leave it as an inheritance to your sons forever. Where was that quoted? Where is he citing? Where is he quoting? In the law. Deuteronomy 7. Deuteronomy 7. That's right. That was given to the people before they took the land. And the command of Moses was, now when you go in this land, you need to make no deals with the people. You make no covenants with them. You're to exterminate them. You're to take them out of the... Just to take them out and you take their land. Do not take their daughters for your sons. Don't give your sons to their daughters, because they'll lead your hearts away from me. So when Ezra prayed this prayer, he's obviously referencing Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 5, where you can go back and you can read. That was the command of God. So verse 12, we have that passage. Now, to think about all that Judah's been through, okay? They've been through... They went through the siege by the Chaldeans. Then they went through the blood bath. The city just raised to the ground. They saw all the carnage. They were led away in humiliation to captivity. Then they spent 70 years as captives. So they've been through all that. Those that got to go through all that and come back home. Cyrus of the Persians said, you can go back home, build your houses of worship to your gods, all those things. And so they now get back here. First return has been back. Some 80 years or so. And the temple's up. And what do? They go right back to the same mud hole. Right back to the same slop. Like a sow. 2 Peter says a sow, after being washed, returns to her wallowing in the mire. So to think that Judah would do that, go through all this, only again to pick up this old sin, what's that tell you about the people? They're not converted. They're not serious about following God. They don't take it seriously enough, this covenant that they have with the Lord. What about marriage? What was their view of marriage? Since that's our class, we're talking about marriage. And the kind of people that God wanted them to have this relationship with, they didn't give that enough serious thought. And so Ezra has to deal with this. This is a situation that's kind of been thrust into his lap. Going back down this same road again is just unthinkable that they would do this, but did it? They did. That's exactly what they were doing. Okay, now we get to chapter 10. So Ezra has been given the information. He said his prayer as recorded there in chapter 9. And again, if you've not read his prayer, take time to read. It's a beautiful, beautiful prayer. The thoughts that he expresses. So for reconciliation with God to occur, it says in chapter 10, verse 1, while Ezra was praying and making confession. How was he taking all this, as verse 1 describes him? What's he doing? He's weeping. And he is prostrating himself. He's on his face before the Lord. A very large assembly, men, women, and children, gathered to him from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, answered and said to Ezra. Now here's somebody who's thinking straight. What's he say? Okay, we have trespassed. We have been unfaithful. And have married foreign women from the peoples of Israel, from the land, and yet now, so we've done this, okay? Here's what we've done. We've been unfaithful. But there's a but in here. There's hope. Now, there's a sermon right there. Doesn't matter what sin you preach on, what topic can be studied, doesn't matter to what depth someone will sink in the mind. As long as there's breath in the body, what is there? There's hope. But now, what's going to happen for that hope to be realized? They're going to have to want to change, aren't they? Can you pull those people out of that hole they're in? You can't pull them out. They're going to have to, you can help them out, yes, but they've got to want to get out of that hole. And so they say, They've taken the first step. We have been unfaithful. We've done wrong. But yet there is hope. So they're bringing their plight to Ezra, wanting him to lead in this matter. Now something else they emphasize. Verse 3, so now let us make a covenant with our God and put away all the wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Arise, they say, for this matter is your responsibility. They're just, Ezra, you've got to help us out here. You've got to take the lead in this. You're the teacher. You're the one who's been sent back here with us to teach us the law again and set these things back in order. So the matter is your responsibility. But we will be with you. So they implore him to be courageous and act. Now drop down to verses 9 through 14 and then 16 to 17. And what are we led to believe also? Especially we want to look at verse 10. The charge is you've been unfaithful. Therefore make confession, verse 11. And do His will. It's one thing to know the Lord's will, but then you have to do it. Do His will. And separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives. Verse 12. The people gave Ezra a what? They gave him an amen, didn't they? They said, that's right. But there's a but there. What did they say? What's the problem? Well, they can't stand outside. It's the rainy season. But and there's something else too. This will not get done overnight. I mean, this is a process. This tells us how widespread the problem was. So I'm not giving them an excuse not to do what's right, but they recognize we're going to have to work through this. It's not just going to happen just right now. So they make that request, it seems, of Ezra. Okay? The last part of question 8. Was there any opposition? Look at verse 15. Ezra proposed to do all this. You can read his proposition in terms of bringing them through by family. I mean, just not having everybody show up at once, that would be chaos. But they did it by tribe or by family. But verse 15 tells us something. So there was some opposition. Now, for whatever reason they opposed it, the Bible doesn't say. We're going to make an application of that just in a moment. But something was on their minds, and they weren't going to go for this. Now, obviously, they're going to be in the wrong in that because the law did say to do that. But there was some opposition to this. Now, however, what he had commanded was the will of God that we read a moment ago, and people had to do it. This is the will of God, and now you've got to do it. You've got yourself in these situations. You've got to come out of it. Now, let's not be naive. This wasn't going to be easy. And I don't just mean exactly what they imply in verse 13, that the task cannot be done in 1 or 2 days. Why was this not going to be easy? And this is the thought question, question 9. What was going to make this tough? You think there could have been some emotional arguments made? Drop down to verse 44. Now, we didn't read that, but toward the end of this chapter, what are we reminded of there? Buford just said, there's children. Now, they've been in these marriages. They then had families. They've had children born. And so someone could say, what kinds of emotional arguments? Well, what about the children? I mean, we've got families now. What are we supposed to do with all of these children? I've married this woman. We've been married 15, 20. I've been faithful to her. We've had children. We have a nice place to live. And now you tell me to do what? Well, I can't do that. Does that sound familiar? That sounds familiar, doesn't it? So they could have made a lot of emotional arguments. But what would those emotional arguments have to do with what the law said? The word is nothing. The answer is nothing. It would have nothing to do with what the law demanded. That's right. We're supposed to have done it in the first place. Emotional arguments do not change nor sway what the Word of God plainly says on the subject, does it? In any situation, relationships. What about salvation? You know that fellow, he got squashed like a bug by a Mack truck on his way to be baptized. And what's God going to do about that? I'm going to let God deal with that. That's an emotional argument. We can sit here and go through all the emotional arguments and consider them all and talk about them and think about them. And when we get through thinking about those arguments, we still are faced, are we not, with what the Word of God says. That hasn't changed. We still must deal with what is said. And so here are these families, these children. You think our hearts don't bleed for that situation? They do. But as Freddie said a moment ago, they shouldn't have been in that position in the first place. And so now they're told, you've got to sever these marriages. They are not lawful. They're against the law of God. Okay, our time is up for this morning. We'll finish Ezra. On Wednesday night, the Lord willing, then we'll get into Malachi chapter 2. We're inching closer and closer toward looking at some of these New Testament passages then that deal with the subject of marriage and divorce. Thank you for your participation this morning. If you didn't get a copy of the new material,